From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Intel, one of the advice, you got a group of about 50 charging up the hill on the west front, just north of the stairs. They're approaching the wall now.
We need some reinforcements up here now. They're starting to pull the gates down. They're throwing metal poles at us. Cruiser 50, give me DSL up here now. DSL. Multiple law enforcement entries. DSL, get up here.
It will take future generations of forensic psychologists to figure out how so many of our elected leaders were able to sit diffidently through recorded evidence of how close their colleagues, and in fact they themselves, were to a very uncertain fate on January 6, 2021. How these leaders and their partisan media colluders are able to relentlessly minimize and dismiss the unprecedented desecration of the halls of power, the terror of innocent victims, the injury and even murder of dedicated law enforcement officers, all in the name of what? Politics? Party loyalty? Trumpism? It will take future generations of theologians to analyze the way a dominant strain in American political Christianity continues to ridicule, minimize, and dismiss the profound fear and suffering of the defenders of democracy, all in the name of God's will. It will take future historians to compare the lack of loyalty to our Constitution that so many of our leaders continue to display, and to compare that with the kind of bravery and unity Americans were able to muster in earlier times, the kind of pride we are able to take in the acts of the greatest generation, of our heroes and patriots who used to be able to rise above politics in defense of the principles that united us for centuries. And it will take a future episode of our program to react to the outcome of this impeachment trial and the actions of the key figures as we record this week's show on Thursday. But even as the trial continues, we've got other important topics to address today.
In the long history of this country of using scripture and weaponizing and abusing scripture to justify bigotry, white supremacists have done it. Those who justified slavery did it. Those who fought against integration did it. And we're seeing it today. The only time religious freedom is invoked is in the name of bigotry and discrimination.
While the precious concept of religious freedom is currently being squandered on protecting privileges like unlimited church stuffing in a time of deadly pandemic, there are much broader themes this cornerstone constitutional concept represents. An important new book, perfectly timed for Black History Month, African Americans and Religious Freedom, has just been published by the Freedom Forum, and I look forward to meeting editor Sabrina Dent later in the hour.
If you're missing out on Valentine kissing, here's the answer to your woe.
February 14th is Valentine's Day. As our society grows ever more diverse, a growing number of us are navigating the challenges of dating, marriage, and building families across faith lines. Susan Katz-Miller is an expert on the topic and will be back with us to talk about the challenges and rewards of interfaith love.
You won't make any exceptions for rape. You won't make any exceptions for incest in this. You are proffering a divine intervention as the reason why you won't do that. whether you believe rape and incest are actually the will of God.
So you're saying that God is not sovereign with every activity that happens in someone's life and can't use anything and everything in someone's life.
The political religious right in this country is reacting to the election of Joe Biden as would a hydra, decentralizing its theocratic vision for America into state-level action that requires close and careful monitoring. The affiliate network of Interfaith Alliance is an essential antidote to that threat, and this week you'll meet the new executive director of Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma, Dr. Noel Jacobs. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners, many of you. If you've made a donation this week, please know how thankful we are for your support. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. It's a Valentine's Day weekend, and I think all of us could use a little love right about now. So I'm pleased to welcome journalist Susan Katz-Miller, author of several important books on building family across faith lines, back to State of Belief Radio. Hello, Susan.
I'm so glad to be here.
America's growing religious diversity is sure to be increasing the number of couples dating across lines of faith and even no faith. Do you have a sense of how large those numbers might be?
It's certainly a trend. Just in the last 10 years, most recently, about 40% of marriages are mixed religion couples. And that could be a Jew married to a Christian, or it could be a Christian married to an atheist, or it could be a Muslim married to a Hindu, because we have all kinds of religious diversity now here.
I wonder how often trying to build relationships across religious differences leads to both partners reducing the importance they place on faith. Do you have a sense of that and whether that helps or hurts in the long run?
There's a lot of different ways that it can play out. It used to be thought that in order to have an interfaith marriage, you would both have to kind of reduce your religiosity and become less religious. But I don't think that's true anymore. There are so many choices. There are so many kinds of religious communities that are open to interfaith families now. They're more accepted. And I think in some ways, it used to be that those couples couldn't find religious homes, couldn't find religious communities. And so they would end up kind of doing nothing. And now there are a lot more choices. So if you're an interfaith couple, you can choose one religion, you can choose the other, you can choose both, you can choose none. And what I say is none of those are bad choices. They all have different benefits and drawbacks. And it really depends on who you are, who your partner is, and on the geographic area you're in, because you don't know what choices you have for community. And you might have to, you know, you might think you want to do one thing and then you can't find a church or a synagogue or a mosque that will accommodate what you want to do. Then you might end up heading in a different direction, depending on what's available to you.
Susan, you've written extensively about the benefits of building a multi-faith family. I wish you would just talk about dating and falling in love across the barriers that used to be barriers, but now don't have to be.
Sure. I think, you know, there used to be this narrative that interfaith love, interfaith relationships were going to be a problem, and that you would have these challenges, and how are you going to overcome them? And I think there's really a new framework now, which is that interfaith couples are happening, and how can we make them successful? How can we be successful as an interfaith couple? And so it's a lot more of a positive framework instead of just being defensive and having arguments about why your relationship is not problematic, mm-hmm. that instead I encourage couples to think of themselves as interfaith educators, as interfaith ambassadors, as being a little bit religiously bilingual, and that these are all positive ways at looking at a situation in which you are going to be learning about your partner's religion, they're going to be learning about yours, and together you're going to be teaching your extended family and the society around you about what it looks like to be able to have that kind of empathetic, compassionate, educational relationship between people of two different cultures.
What are some of the challenges, because there are some, that one should keep in mind when embarking on an interfaith relationship?
The challenge that usually people focus on is, how are you going to raise the children? And what people should know is that Pew Research actually surveyed children of interfaith families, and 3/4 of them said that their parents disagreed not much or not at all about religion. So the fear that you're going to confuse your children, or that there's going to be discord in the home, really looks like it's a myth when you look at the statistics. And now we have generations of experience with this. So in my family, I had a Jewish father, a Protestant mother. They married in 1960. I grew up as an interfaith kid. And now I have children who are adults themselves, and they're third generation interfaith family. Everybody's noticing this recently because our new vice president, Kamala Harris, is from an interfaith family. She had a Hindu parent and a Christian parent. She made a decision to be a Christian, and then she married a Jew. So this is a family where I call it the interfaith trifecta. You have 3 religions, and this is becoming more and more common. I am coaching interfaith couples now where each of the members of that partnership are from interfaith families themselves, and you might have 3 or even 4 religions in the heritage. So is it complicated? Yes. Are there issues? Are there challenges? Yes. But I insist on people realizing, noticing that there are also ways that this is enriching, that this is, for me, it's exhilarating. For me, it's inspiring. Mm-hmm.
Do you think those who identify as atheist or non-affiliated might be surprised to learn how important faith is to their more religious partner?
Sure. And the religious partner may be surprised to learn how important that secular identity is to their partner. Mm-hmm. So it has to be mutual. And they're going to have to listen to each other and learn from each other in the same way that a partnership of, say, a Buddhist and a pagan have to do the same thing. So something I often say, and others have said it, is that every couple on some level is an interfaith couple, because no two people have identical beliefs or identical practices. Even if you're both Presbyterians, or, you know, you're both Jewish, you're going to have different family cultures, different ways of celebrating holidays, different ideas about what happens to us when we die. You cannot assume what someone believes based on their religious label. So say you're dating somebody who tells you that they are a Buddhist, you don't really know what that means. You can't assume what that means by reading about Buddhism. You have to talk to your partner and find out, you know, what kind of Buddhism do they ascribe to? Who were their mentors? You know, which parts of it are the parts that speak to them that they are talking about when they say that they have that identity?
You know, it's interesting, and I'm sure you experience this too, but I more and more hear from people who are really interested in interfaith work, you know, it's easier for me to deal with other people in other faiths than it is with me with the people in my own faith.
That can be true. Yeah. That can be true. I have to say, though, I'm sometimes frustrated when people are engaged with interfaith dialogue, interfaith community service, interfaith engagement, but they're not willing to talk about interfaith families. Yeah. Because to me, an interfaith family is a microcosm of interfaith engagement, where you're doing that kind of listening and learning, but it's within the family. And they are absolutely connected. But I think there's sometimes a fear of talking about interfaith families when you want to keep all the different religions involved in your interfaith engagement project.
You published a resource for multi-faith families that I'd like to bring to our listeners' attention. What made you want to create the Interfaith Family Journal?
So when my first book about interfaith families came out almost a decade ago now, I began to hear from young couples and older couples who wanted me to coach them. And I will do an hour or two with a couple, but I'm not a therapist by training. And then I'll turn them over to a therapist if they need more help or to a pastoral counselor. But I began to realize I can't help individually all of these couples that are coming to me. And I think they came to me because I had a certain amount of objectivity. I'm not a clergy person. I'm not pushing a particular way of being in an interfaith family or an interfaith couple, but I'm helping couples figure out what's the best way for them. And so I realized that if I created this resource, which is really a workbook, I could help a lot more couples. It's a 5-week program where you have writing prompts and then you have questions to help you engage with your partner. And then there are actually creative activities. For instance, 1 week I suggest making an interfaith family cookbook where you go to your extended relatives and you collect the recipes from each side and you create this kind of beautiful thing together, the cookbook, which represents the interfaithness of your family. So there are chapters about investigating what was meaningful to you in your religious background, and then what part of that do you want to bring forward into your family with your new partner. And then there is a chapter on how to honor both religions when you go through life cycle events, a birth, a marriage, a coming of age, and death. And then the final chapter is about how to work with extended family, especially when they are not comfortable with what you're doing in your interfaith couple. So often you have, let's call him Great Uncle Joe, who is not happy that you've chosen a different religion, not his religion. Yeah. And a lot of this chapter is about having empathy for Great Uncle Joe and helping him to realize that you do honor him, you do respect him, you do want him to help transmit some of his culture, his history. He can share, say, songs and recipes, even though you may have chosen a different religious identity for his great nieces and nephews.
Yeah. You were on the show back in 2013 with the release of your book, Being Both, Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family. The religious landscape has changed quite a bit in this country. I wonder if you have some observations on the changes that have been made, and at the same time, on some of the aspects of interfaith relationships and families that have remained constant.
I'm really encouraged at the number of communities that have become more sensitized to interfaith families in their midst and more welcoming to interfaith families, more willing to share those families when they know that there's more than one religion being practiced or more than one religion in the heritage. I see a lot of forward movement. There are more opportunities, for instance, for a rabbi to be ordained, even if they are in an interfaith relationship themselves, which was something that really wasn't possible 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all become more aware of the diversity, the religious diversity in our country. And, you know, we're going to school together, we're working together. Inevitably, love is going to happen, which is a beautiful thing. And so I'm very optimistic in a lot of ways. That said, there are still challenges, and especially when we pan out beyond the United States, there are places in the world where it is still dangerous to be an interfaith couple, where it is illegal to be an interfaith couple, where a couple cannot legally marry if they are from two different faiths. And so I see myself as an advocate for the acceptance of interfaith families globally. No matter what choices they make about the identity of themselves or their children, I want there to be space for those families. I want them to feel safe. And I want the world to understand that there are positive aspects to being part of an interfaith family and not just challenging ones.
Susan Katzmiller is an author and journalist who is both an interfaith child and an interfaith parent, a top expert on interfaith families celebrating more than one religion. Susan is the author of the Interfaith Family Journal and Being Both: Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family. Happy Valentine's Day, Susan.
And to you.
Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You too.
Up next, African Americans and Religious Freedom. And later, Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Religion plays an important role in the lives of many African Americans, a source of identity, encouragement, and of comfort. It does not demand recognition and accommodation in the public square nearly as loudly as does the dominant strain of political Christianity in this country. But it is, in reality, subject to far greater threats as racism continues to take a social and economic toll on minority communities of all kinds in this country. A wide-ranging and insightful book titled African Americans and Religious Freedom: New Perspectives for Congregations and Communities has recently been released by the Freedom Forum, and I am very happy that Sabrina Dent is with us today on State of Belief Radio. Dr. Dent, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy. It's such a pleasure to be here with you today.
What was the idea behind this collection of essays, and who is the intended audience for this book?
This book came about as a byproduct of a 3-year project that was funded by the Henry Luce Foundation to really examine African-American perspectives on religious freedom. And so we took this grant and we made it possible for seminary students, as well as the public, to engage more critically on this topic, to think about the complex politics of race and religion in this country. And so a lot of people have a limited understanding of religious freedom in this country, just based on one's right to believe or not to believe, or freedom of conscience. Whereas for African Americans and other racial and religious minorities, it's not as just simple as saying your beliefs are not. So in this class, which we had many scholars to participate on this project, and one of my co-collaborators on this and leading scholar was Dr. Corey D.B. Walker, who is now the professor of the Wake Forest Professor of the Humanities at Wake Forest University. And so we got together as with some of the leaders from the historically Black theological institutions, the deans, the presidents. We got together with some of our community partners, such as the BJC, which is the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, as well as scholars such as Dr. Eric Williams at the African American Museum, specifically the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, as well as religious partners such as Rama Abdulaleem from Karama, and also Pastor William H. Lamar IV. And so there were many other people that weighed in on this conversation. And so we did two cohorts of students for a class that we offered about African Americans and religious freedom. And so it involved theological education, museum education, as well as civic education. And then we had public symposiums that we offered. But at the end of the day, we realized that if it's not written, for some people, it never happened. And so it was like, how do we take what we've done over the last 3 years and put it in a resource that translates this information so the larger community can engage in conversations or begin to start expanding their understanding of the narrative about religious freedom in this country? And so here we birthed this book, which had 9 contributing authors, plus we had Ambassador Susan Johnson Cook, which was critical to have her to be a part of this, because a lot of people don't realize that not only was she the first Black woman to be the ambassador at large for international religious freedom, she was also the first faith leader to take that role. And so it's a part of history that people should know about, and it deepens people's understanding of religion and religious freedom in this country when it comes from the perspectives of individuals who did not have human freedom.
Yeah. Sabrina, are there parallels between the suppression of African-American voices in our culture and public dialogue and disregard for religious freedom in churches that prominently serve Black communities?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was, if you want, the most prevalent example of that is most recently what happened in December 12th of 2020, when the Proud Boys went to historic Black churches and took down Black Lives Matter signs. And so Reverend William H. Lamar, who's the pastor of Metropolitan AME Church, wrote about it extensively in a Washington Post op-ed. And so here you have this moment that happened in history where a sign that affirmed the life and dignity of a group of people was snatched down in front of a church. Now, I often bring up to people in conversations when I'm talking about it, it didn't happen at a library, right, which serves everyone. So, and here's the thing, religious communities serve everyone, but they went to historic Black churches. So for me, it goes back to the history in America, like when we have to go back to looking at the foundation here in the United States. So keeping in mind that the founding framers of the Constitution, most of them were slaveholders. And so when you're drafting a document that speaks to the religious freedom or the right to have religious freedom and to interpret it so broadly, and yet you have failed to tackle the issue of slavery and human freedom, then you have to tie those things together and say, well, if this group is not free to be human, then how are they free to really practice their beliefs? Because then they were given religion, and I take that back. They were given a westernized religion because they came and they were brought to the Americas with their own, keeping in mind that 30% of enslaved Africans identified as Muslims. And then you had those that were practicing African traditions. So what does it mean to say that you don't have the right to be, to exist, to practice, to believe because of what you look like, features that you might have, or from whence your family came? Mm. And so, yes, there is this parallel. I often think about Jennifer Bailey said back in July or June, I should say, of 2015, when the Charleston shooting happened at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. She was in one of her interviews. She said, "You cannot talk about religion in America and not talk about race." You have to have conversations about both of these. And so although people would like to separate it, you can't. Because historically, the nation's DNA tells us that these things are intertwined. And that's why we say the complex politics of race and religion in America.
Mm. Teresa L. Smallwood in Chapter 2 writes, "In our contemporary moment, religious freedom is fraught with cultural, legal, and political problematics that reflect the deep ideological divides over race in America." What is, in your mind, what is the most obvious of these problems, and how can we best address them?
Wow, I don't want to speak for Dr. Teresa, but she gave so much in the chapter that she provided, and even in the lectures that she did in the course. I mean, we have to think back to how policies are written. And how, not just how policies are written, but also the judicial system, how cases are heard. And so one of the things that I often think about in a more current context is I often reflect back on the case in Alabama with Dominic Ray, who was the African-American Muslim who was on death row. And he asked for his imam to be present for his last rites of passage. But yet what was provided to him was a Christian, or offered to him was a Christian chaplain. And so for me, when I looked at that case, I didn't look at it just as like the fact that he was denied the rights to his religious leader, but also just looking at, you know, who he is as a person. And that's the thing that is important, is like when we're talking about cases in the United States, when we're looking at the nuances of it, especially when it involves people of color, I want to ask these questions like, you know, well, who's involved? What is the impact of the case? How were they impacted by decisions that were made? What rights were they stripped of? Even when you want to think about religious minorities in this country, right? Whether or not Sikhs have the right to wear their turbans, or whether or not people, Muslims, are allowed to have their beards. And so these questions, and I think about this often, is what is the racial identity of this person? Mm-hmm. Also, what is the economic status of the individual that's being challenged? So, or being impacted by the issues. So, and that has shown up throughout time. And so, and not to put words into Dr. Teresa's mouth, but when you look at the codes, like the slave codes that happened throughout time, and how, who had the right to worship or who had the right to exist. And even there's a, if you go to Williamsburg, and I know this because as a BJC fellow, we spent a week down in Williamsburg, and there was an interpreter that they had. But the story is significant because What he wanted was he wanted to be affirmed by being accepted by his religious community. As a Black man, he wanted to be accepted by the community, and yet they would not give him the right hand of fellowship. Now, anyone that knows that in religious traditions, especially in the Christian tradition, the Baptist tradition, is that there is this right hand of fellowship where it affirms your identity in the religious community. But because he was a Black enslaved person, they didn't do that. So what he did is he challenged them by saying, if these are your religious beliefs that say we're all a part of this family of gods, then you have to accept me into it. And for him, the acceptance came in the fact that the right hand of fellowship was more than his acceptance into the religious community, but it was the affirmation of his humanity. And so for me, like when I'm talking about this, this is about human dignity, not just for people of color, but for everyone, where we're talking about religious freedom and where we're looking at social justice issues. So it shows up in many different ways, even how religious freedom right now is being weaponized to prevent others from having rights, whether it's reproductive health care, whether it's access to services or employment. There are layers of things that come up. And one of the things that we wrote about in Chapter 7 is that we talked about how it impacts like women of color when we're talking about this in terms of religious freedom, because women of color are one have a high maternal mortality rate, as well as there's a high infant mortality rate. And so when you're talking about not granting someone access to healthcare or services that they need, and they're in a community that is often marginalized and don't have adequate access sometimes to these resources, then it's more than just, again, about what one believes and what one doesn't. For some people, it is a matter of life and death. The religious freedom world has been a white male dominated world. And so for the fact that I'm even existing in this space to do this work and to help disrupt the narrative for what people have known presents its own, you know, layers of questions and issues as well. But it's just a matter of like that people have to, again, I go back to people have to see themselves in the narrative, and the narrative has to be presented in a way in which they can connect to the issues. And I say that even often in the work that I do, whether I'm trying to help organize a webinar around issues such as, for example, talking about prioritizing public schools over private school vouchers, right? When you talk about the implications of that, when funding gets shifted to private religious schools that have an agenda because they're based on their religious beliefs versus public schools, which serves everyone and is not based on one's religious identity or have like certain exceptions as far as the enrollment of the child or the family, then people have to look at that. Another thing is, when we created the course, and I have to keep going back to the course because the book is like the byproduct. But for me, the course was even powerful because to have 70 seminarians enroll in an intensive course to really gain a deep understanding of this topic through the lens and experience of history, the current context, and to really examine civic education and the civic frameworks of the First Amendment was really important. But the thing that a lot of people were astonished by is like when the class was created, and we had other classes at the Freedom Forum that we were offering at the time, they were like, why do you think the enrollment is high for this particular class over the other classes? And I said, because it specifically names a community to be associated with this issue. If it wasn't that way, I don't know if we would have had a high enrollment, because in the past we had African-Americans and people of color to take the classes, but their narratives, their experiences, the experiences of their ancestors, the stories throughout history, whether we're talking about the 16th Street bombing, which people see as just was a racial issue. But I'm like, nope, that was racial and religious discrimination. Like, we have to start retelling the stories and the narratives for people to get a better understanding of it. And even for people to broaden their understanding, like you said, of the African-American community, the Black community. Like, culture is big to us, right? And so it's embedded in how we worship, how we navigate life, how we commune with family. So people have to really take some time to really get a better understanding of religious identity. And I have to give a plug in for that. My colleague, Ben Marcus, at the Freedom Forum, he does work on that, when he talks about how people need to have a broader understanding of religious identity. You can't just look at a person and say, oh, they're a Black Christian, so this is what they believe. It's really about engaging in dialogue and asking further questions as to why that person identifies the way that they do, because you might find that they have different beliefs about different ideas, whether it's about Roe versus Wade or whether it's about, you know, about incarceration or other issues that might come up. You have to speak to the person individually. And so I think, but my message to everyone would be to really sit and talk to people, not just one person, but several people, to get a deeper understanding of what people believe. I grew up Pentecostal. And so growing up Pentecostal, you know, there were certain beliefs that my community ascribed to. However, I ended up being a Baptist minister, licensed as a Baptist minister. I, at some point in my life, studied Scientology and also attended Buddhist meditation. And so, and I was once married to a Catholic. So my spiritual journey is very eclectic, which is why I simply identify as spiritual. But a lot of times when people read my bio and they see that I went to seminary, they automatically assume my religious identity without asking me. And I think that is important for people to do, is to really ask the questions of people of color that they know, and even that they don't know, to organically engage in some type of dialogue, to ask them what is their position on the issues. This book only captures just a few of the many different perspectives of our community, and we hope to expand that conversation even more.
In the final essay of this collection, you and Keisha I. Patrick write, "Religious conservatives dominate the public discourse on religious freedom in America." Corey D.B. Walker calls for an understanding of religious freedom that moves us toward democracy. I think those two go together, and I would like to know, what are the first steps for dealing with both of these issues?
So I would say very quickly, the first step is, I encourage people to go to the Freedom Forum website, download this book, and read it. That's one thing. The next thing is, in the public square, to really broaden your understanding of religious freedom and the issues that impact all of us. And then one thing is, I say this, to pay attention to the conversations around Christian nationalism, right? Christian nationalism right now, and I would say this, white Christian nationalism, because there are people that identify as evangelical who are people of color who do not ascribe to the beliefs of those that are pushing this thing around Christian nationalism, which is, for those that don't know what that is basically saying that what it means to be American is that you're a Christian, and that is not what it means to be American. The Constitution states that everyone has the freedom of conscience. It says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So there should not be a sanctioned religion. There is not. The United States, although people think it is a Christian nation, it was not founded as one, and that everyone has the right to freedom of conscience or belief, no matter what they believe or don't believe. And that includes people that identify as atheists, as Satanists, as Christians, as Hindus, as Baha'is. And so, again, people need to get a better understanding of religion, religious identity, and they need to really look back at history and re-examine how history has been told from a certain perspective, and then pay attention to the perspectives that we're now providing.
The Reverend Dr. Sabrina Dent is Senior Faith Advisor at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and a fellow at the Religious Freedom Center of the Freedom Forum. The book is titled African Americans and Religious Freedom, New Perspectives for Congregations and Communities, published by the Freedom Forum. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy. I appreciate the opportunity to share, and I look forward to expanding this conversation because there's much more to tell.
For 4 years, the extremist political religious right had free reign in this country, making ever greater claims of rights and exemptions and leveraging public ignorance or discomfort with some of the most marginalized persons in this country to push back as much as they possibly could on the incremental progress these communities had managed in the previous decades. In very real ways, the fox was put in charge of guarding the hen house. With different philosophies and principles sweeping across the nation's capital, a lot of the focus for the relentless religious right has shifted to the states, where partisan elected officials and hordes of hastily confirmed judges wait ready to do its bidding. As the misapplication of religious freedom concepts spread in many states, so does the mandate of Interfaith Alliance and its local affiliates to protect true religious freedom for all. And Oklahoma has been seen more than its fair share of assaults. With me right now is Dr. Noel Jacobs, the new executive director of Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma. I'm glad you're with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, Reverend Gaddy.
As busy as you are with your medical practice, what made you want to take on this leadership position at a time like this?
I became involved with the Interfaith Alliance in 2011 after going through some of my own developmental process related to understanding others. I grew up here in Oklahoma. I saw and met some of the best people that I will ever meet. I also saw some, as I grew more understanding of this, some of the worst discrimination and practices of intolerance that I saw anywhere in the travels that I went later in life. Knowing those two things coexisted, that there were great loving individual people, and then there were these group practices that harmed the other, whether that other was someone of a different faith, someone of a different sexual orientation or gender identity, religious background from cultural practices. It really spurred me to become involved in this. And since I have seen better days and I've seen worse days in our state. And we've had a terrific history with people like Reverend Jeff Hamilton, who is our legislative icon. He followed every bill in the legislature to know when we needed to be following up, getting members alerted, and speaking back into the political process.
Yeah. What are some of the priority issues Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma is focusing on right now?
I would say foremost in our mind are the actions of the legislature and the governor around the current COVID-19 pandemic. One of the things that we've seen is that our state rushed back to being open very quickly, and we have some of the highest infection rates and per capita, some of the highest mortality rates in the country. In fact, we have been compared with whole countries in the level of loss that we've had. And chief among the arguments has been the need to be free to worship in person, as is the strong desire of many communities. And we have actually had to push back a little bit on that related to an understanding of science and public safety and health, and the fact that we are at a better place than ever in being able to meet and pray virtually, to worship together online, and in creative use of space, including outdoor spaces. So that has been one of the things that we've seen politically that we've had to speak back into. But there are a host of laws being considered right now in House bills and Senate bills that relate to things that we have to be paying attention to, speaking to our constituency, and then giving voice back into the legislature about who we're representing and why we believe the way we do about certain legislation. Some of those are, for example, a bill being considered right now that's an initiative petition that actually makes it much harder for individual citizens in Oklahoma to bring potential legislation to the forefront for consideration. The rights of individuals to create bills is actually being threatened right now.
Hmm. Do you find that a growing number of people in the state are finally waking up to the very real threats facing religious freedom for all?
That's a difficult conversation in Oklahoma, because the way you couch the idea of threat to religious freedom is different depending on who you speak to.
Yeah.
There are many conservative religious organizations in Oklahoma, houses of worship, that believe that Christianity is the only religion under threat right now, and specifically conservative Christianity. Whereas the actual rights of other groups that clearly include their religious beliefs, for example, immigrants. We believe that immigration reform is a religious freedom issue, partly because people come here because of intolerance in their own communities. And if they're not allowed in and they're not given provision and help, then their own safety continues to be threatened. So we believe in supporting immigration reform in a way that helps more people get to us. Oklahoma almost closed its borders on immigrants under the executive orders in the last presidency. And we saw our numbers shrink, and we saw support for immigrants shrink. And a whole lot of that was due to legislative pressure. So we believe that communities that feel they're being harmed may not be the ones that are actually at risk of harm.
What are the ways the Interfaith Alliance brings people together across lines of both division and difference?
We host a series of talks. In the past, of course, we did them in person. And since last April, we have been doing them online. And we are at about the place where we're having at least one per month, where we get people from different religious backgrounds together. Some of the things that we're talking about are civil rights issues. Some of the things that we're talking about are simply, how do you get to know, understand, and show golden rule behavior towards someone who has a different religious or cultural background than yourself? So we have a very robust amount of engagement through our groups like Amazing Faiths and Many Beliefs Serving Together. Mm-hmm. Many Beliefs Serving Together used to put people of different beliefs, including atheists and agnostics, but then all of the host of religious groups in Oklahoma City metro area together for public service projects where they would work together for a full day, get to know each other and have dialogue about differences and similarities in their own journeys. And since we have had to move remote for our activities, we have actually recreated some of the activities in online formats where you're still getting to know your neighbor and discuss things, including politics, but across our religious and cultural background differences.
Yeah. As the leader there, what would be two or three goals that you'd love to see achieved in your first year of leadership?
One is to give all the people of Oklahoma, and that includes people in rural areas, more knowledge about what we're doing that they can join in on for learning, for dialogue and input, and for starting to understand other people's points of views. We do have a tremendous amount of religious diversity in Oklahoma, and we do not spend enough time talking to each other across our differences. And one of the biggest differences that we have in Oklahoma is the rural versus urban divide. we have a pretty 50-50 state where 50% live in one of the three biggest metropolitan areas in Oklahoma, and the rest live in much smaller rural communities. We want to let everybody get to know each other through some intentional dialogue that we are planning for the rest of the year, where we have some pastors and some interfaith leaders who are actually reaching out to smaller parts of the state to have ongoing dialogue. So that's one, connecting us across the state. Second is becoming a place online and through our meetings where people can find out more about what's going on, both activities that connect us, but then also things like legislation that can end up dividing us further. We want to be a hub of communication. We are partners with the Oklahoma Conference of Churches in many of these ways because Reverend Shannon Fleck and her group are terrific at creating moments where these larger communities get together with the smaller communities that we have. So we're looking forward to that. I would say thirdly, we really want to be getting public media messages out there that run counter to some of the messages of division that we are hearing every day, whether it is online or in news media or on air in local networks. We want to see billboard, print, radio, public service announcements that let people know the golden rule is out there for all of us. And when we take the time to get to know each other, develop an understanding and relationship where we can trust and see the other as human, all of a sudden, a whole lot of the things that divide us fall away. So we want a larger media presence in Oklahoma. That would be my third goal.
As if you didn't have enough to do already, I understand that in your work with Oklahoma University, you have created some very helpful materials for kids related to COVID.
So we found last spring, as schools were shutting down, families were starting to work from home, children were cut off from relational time with each other, teenagers lost their social life except for what was online, there were two things happening. One, stress and concern about what things were going to be like through the pandemic were growing. Second, there was information and misinformation going out about the virus itself. Working in a health center, I have the privilege of working around people in infectious disease, pediatricians who give their lives to teaching kids and parents about how we grow up healthy and stay safe. And in my own area of health psychology, what I saw were kids in distress that needed tools and parents that needed to be able to have conversations. So in collaboration with some people, we developed animated videos, two about 4 minute shorts that show one family having a conversation around the dinner table where one of the parents, one of the caregivers, is a healthcare provider working with COVID patients and therefore living separately to maintain safety in the household. Mm. This allowed us to have conversations about what is a virus for the younger children, for the older children. Why does it mean that I have to have a difference in my social life? And for parents talking to all of their kids, it deals with how do we handle our emotions through this? Because it's okay that not all of our emotions are good or happy. We're going to be stressed. We're going to be sad. We're going to be angry at times. And a lot of that is coming from the stress that's created by the way we have to live differently and concern, anxiety about the pandemic itself. Mm. So these videos are designed to be reachable to any age, great ways for parents to start having conversations, short enough that they don't bore young children, and joining. We have relationship in there. We have a little bit of humor. We have characters that are relatable, and then we have good medical sound advice. It was a joy for me to be able to do that, and we're hoping to be able to do more.
The language of religious freedom has been weaponized in this country. It's been used to set neighbor against neighbor. How optimistic are you that with our efforts and the efforts of many others, the tide may yet turn on this destructive direction that seems to attract so many Americans?
Certainly. If I didn't believe that we as a nation in my state, Oklahoma, the people that live here, and specifically the Interfaith Alliance, did not have the tools needed to help us bridge divides, get to know, trust, and understand each other, I would not be doing this work. Some people call me a hopeless optimist. I believe that I am a scientifically attuned optimist because I know that at our core, we want to be connected for community. I believe that with our messages, we can overcome these bridges and have better days ahead.
Dr. Noel Jacobs is a child psychologist and professor of pediatrics who, since the start of this year, heads up Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma. You can learn more at www.tiaok.org. Noel, it's great to meet you. Thank you for taking this time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. We always have a place to sit down and enjoy a cup of coffee or a meal with you when the pandemic allows it. We would love to have you back in Oklahoma, and we will keep working hard on behalf of all the work that you've done for the years that you've been there.
Thank you, sir. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Mm-hmm.